This is Truth Frequency Radio.
No hate, no hype, no fear. Real people, real radio.
I love that theme song. I've neglected to mention who that is. That's a band called Imagine Dragons. And I was sent that song by a good friend of mine named Jeff and absolutely fell in love with it right away. I think probably they're talking about being radioactive from Fukushima. But we're kind of playing it like a double entendre, being active on the radio. And I hope that song picks you guys up before the show like it does me, gets me pumped up to be here. Again, my name's J.D. Moore. We are live right now, like we are every day, Monday through Friday, from 10 a.m. until noon Central Standard Time. And this is, of course, your Red Pill Report for the 5th of November, 2014. RedPillReports.com is where you want to go to check out the news links for the day and the things that we're going to try and cover today. But I just want to, again, welcome everybody. Anybody who's tuning in new to the program today, thank you very much. We've gotten several really, really wonderful emails from old listeners and new listeners alike, and that has been fantastic to hear. Pardon my pause there. The tornado sirens are being tested right now in my neighborhood, so have no fear. The clouds are not scary looking outside, so I'm going to assume this is the 10 o'clock test. Anyway, getting back to business. I wanted to talk again about the format of the show and what we're trying to do here for just a second. Obviously, it's going to be a two-hour show every day, live, Monday through Friday. First hour of the day, I'm going to do my best, along with the Red Pill team, to bring you the most prevalent and important news of the day. Some of it will be mainstream, because we like to understand what it is that the mainstream is trying to spoon-feed the masses. It's sometimes important to pay attention to what a large group of people might be thinking at one time, and since a large group of people seem to get their cues from the mainstream media, it's important for us to pay attention, kind of to try and figure out where their agenda is going to go. We also have several Red Pill reporters that have signed up and are starting to produce original content for the website. You can see those at redpillreports.com also. So definitely want to keep checking the site out every day for unique and new information that you're not going to get, you know, opinion you're not going to get anyplace else. I want to thank again Chris Gio from Truth Frequency for putting us on the air, taking a shot with a new show, and we have gotten so much good feedback from the other hosts and from other people, and the family at Truth Frequency is just remarkable. So much support, so much just positive nature amongst all the guests. And just want to remind everybody that Truth Frequency is listener-supported, and it means a lot to us for you to go and support their website. Check out the other hosts. Get involved. There's just so many fantastic things going on with that website, and just so excited to be a part of it all. I know that Jeff and Rob, my good friends and helpers at the Red Team, feel the same way. So thank you guys again at Truth Frequency for letting us do this. I want to mention that, as I said earlier, during the 11 o'clock central hour, our intent is to have a guest every day. And today will be no exception. We are going to be joined by who I can only describe as a man who is the preeminent guru on self-preparedness. This gentleman, Matt Stein, went to MIT. He has an engineering degree, and he is essentially, I like to consider him to be kind of an outdoorsy mountaintop MacGyver. and specifically geared towards when things go very, very wrong. But anyway, we're going to have a discussion about Ebola today, and you know, I'm of the opinion also that Ebola's been kept out of the news cycle. Matt's not of that opinion. Matt's been doing a lot of research into this current outbreak, and I think it's important that even if this current outbreak isn't actually as threatening as it seems like it might be, to still talk about being prepared in the event that something like this does happen. So we're going to talk quite a bit today about what we have seen from the international response teams as well as the national response teams, and try and just kind of focus on, you know, whether or not this could get out of hand, whether or not we ought to be doing more paying attention, or whether or not we ought to be doing more to protect ourselves in the event that things go horribly wrong in the future, and the likelihood of something like that happening. I think Matt will be in a very interesting discussion, and I hope you guys stick with me to the 11 o'clock hour. So it's the 5th of November. What's happening out there, guys? I think yesterday probably culminated with you know, obviously the elections happened yesterday. Major deal. The country has now decided to shift gears, and so we now see a culmination of the millions and millions and millions of dollars that have been spent to try and convince you and I that, you know, Team A is better than Team B, and blah blah blah. And I don't know if any of that is true. I personally don't really believe that any of these people have our best interests at heart. But the country did take a massive shift last night. And before we get into that, I have to say one thing. I've got to give a couple of kudos to a couple of states that did some great things, because I'm sure you guys can go on the internet and find out all kinds of information about candidates and things like that, and who won and who lost and the new majority and blah, blah, blah. And we will get to that in just a second. But let's start with the most important thing. And the most important thing, ladies and gentlemen, is that last night, marijuana became legal in Oregon, Alaska, and the District of Columbia. I'm going to give a big round of applause, because I am so thankful that there are people out there who are pushing back and attempting to allow civilization to exist. Now, I'm not saying that I am, you know, a huge supporter of cannabis or anything like that, but from a medical standpoint, there's no reason that this drug should be illegal, certainly not for adults. So last night, Oregon made the switch. They are now going to allow you know, people over the age of 21 to cultivate and purchase marijuana. They're going to tax it, and all that you know, taxation is going to help public schools, mental health services, and probably a lot of it will go to the police force. Alaska's Measure 2 passed yesterday, allowing residents over the age of 21 to possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana and also grow 6 plants. And I'll tell you, the reason that I am so pro-legalization of cannabis, guys, is not just because it's a no-brainer in terms of liberty, but you could replace the economy tomorrow. You know, if you think about the value of cannabis going back in history, just a few years ago, an ounce of cannabis was worth the same as an ounce of gold, which to me is the pinnacle reason why cannabis has not been legal in our country, because the people who run our country, the Fed, you know, they cannot allow people to grow money. You can't just create a barter community like that. But what would that do to our country? Not only if we were to allow hemp production, oh my gosh, think of how much we import from China and from Canada. What that would do to our country and what that would do to our individual states would just be remarkable. But from an individual liberty standpoint, I think it's time that we see this discrimination against people who just want to, you know, utilize a medicinal plant. It needs to stop. And I'm very, very intrigued by the idea that this just passed in D.C. So it's because it's a district, Congress can still veto it. But how crazy would it be for D.C. to have legal marijuana when the rest of us, you know, here in the Midwest are suffering and can't even grow hemp and get our farms off the ground? It's just, it's completely unacceptable to me. So one of the things that we're going to do here in the future is get somebody from Show Me Cannabis on the show to talk about some of the more local initiatives that are going on. Missouri is actually pretty progressive in terms of cannabis, and there's a lot of people fighting for it. But again, you know, this area, the whole Midwest, is a future breadbasket, is a future absolute, you know, billion-dollar industry once we get hemp off the ground. I think we need to do that. So anyway, that's my say on cannabis. I do, I'm super pumped on Oregon. I used to live in Portland and it was a beautiful, beautiful city, and this is only going to make it more civilized. And, man, I'll tell you, the west coast of this country is starting to look pretty darn good. Pretty darn good. So that was kind of my tip of the iceberg for national news. We do want to talk also about the rest of the election. Obviously, major news in the GOP yesterday, riding a huge wave of voter discontent. The resurgent Republicans captured control of the Senate and tightened their grip on the House last night, in elections which are obviously going to complicate Barack Obama's final 2 years in office, which I think is the great threat that is on the table now. I think after this display yesterday of what I can only really classify as disgust with the way the country is going. And that actual disgust was backed up by quite a few exit polls. There are a lot of people, nearly, I think, 2/3 of the people said, you know, the country is way on the wrong track. And so that's a pretty significant amount. But again, I think that now the pressure is going to be on the administration to try and push through all of the things that they want to get pushed through. And I think we'll see shortly that amnesty is going to be right at the top of that list, which falls back into this Ebola debacle, because, and also the Entero 68 thing, where we've got all these major health concerns, we've got these illegal immigrants being bussed all over the country, and Barack Obama is going to push forward an amnesty plan. So we can't have the response to Ebola and Entero 68 that we would need to have, because it would affect his amnesty agenda. So I think this next 2 years is going to be fairly frightening. But in some, you know, semi-good news, I guess Republican Mitch McConnell led the way to a new Senate majority. He dispatched Democratic challenger Allison Langeron down in Kentucky. Two-time incumbent Mark Pryor of Arkansas was the first Democrat to go yesterday, defeated by freshman Representative Tom Cotton. Senator Mark Udall of Colorado was the next one to go, defeated by Representative Cory Gardner. And Senator Kay Hagan also lost in North Carolina to Tom Tillis, the Speaker of the State House. Republicans also picked up seats in Iowa, West Virginia, South Dakota, and Montana, all states where Democrats were retired. And they needed a net gain of 6 seats total to end the Democratic majority in place since 2006, and they were successful in getting that. In the House, there's still dozens of races that are not called yet, but the Republicans have picked up 11 seats that had been in Democratic hands, and they've only given up one. Again, a net pickup of 13 total would give them more seats in the House since any time since 1946. Obama was at the White House yesterday as voters remade the Congress for his final two years in his tenure, and we can only anticipate that he is not very happy. He has called a meeting on Friday to get people together and see if they can start working together. And John Boehner, in line for his third term as head of the House, said the new Republican-controlled Congress would vote soon in the new year on the many common sense jobs and energy bills that passed the Republican-led House in recent years with bipartisan support, but were never even brought to a vote by the outgoing Senate majority. So we're going to see a little bit more action from John Boehner, I believe, and he should have a little bit more power to get some things done. I would imagine that one of the first things they will do is try and defund the Affordable Care Act. At least I hope that's something that they're going to try and do. And, you know, obviously that's the one thing that Barack can hang his hat on as actually having accomplished. So if we could get that removed, that would be wonderful, in my opinion. And then as another White House official said yesterday, and this is according to correspondent John Carl from ABC News, and this is a quote from a White House official, the president will move forward with an executive order on immigration reform, quote unquote, no matter how big a shellacking the Democrats get tonight. And he was, of course, referring to last night's election. The White House officials are saying that you can expect the president to see an aggressive and defiant tone tomorrow. And you're not going to see any mea culpas, no big fringes, no changes in directions from him. Officials say the president is prepared to aggressively pursue his agenda using his power of executive authority when and where he cannot work with Congress, and they anticipate the big one will be immigration reform. So unless he is reined in the next few years, I think we're going to see some major, major battles fighting over immigration, probably fighting over the healthcare system. It's going to be a crazy 2 years, but buckle your seatbelts, because we are, the divide and conquer plan is still alive and kicking. There was a bombshell report that came out from the Daily Caller yesterday, and this is an exclusive. And again, if you go to redpillreports.com, which is our site, at the top of the page there is a link to today's show, and under that link you will find all of these articles. So if you want to follow along, or you want to go back and do some more research after the fact, that is where you will find these things. But this is an exclusive that came out yesterday with a DC Caller, and it's about the IRS scandal. Specifically, it's about Jean Sheehan. Jean Sheehan is the Democratic New Hampshire senator, and according to this report, she was principally involved in a plot with Lois Lerner and President Barack Obama's political appointee at the IRS to lead in that program of harassment against conservative nonprofit groups during the 2012 election. And they actually have documents to support this over at the Daily Caller. The Internal Revenue Service did not want to publicly release these 2012 correspondences exchanged between the IRS and Jean Sheehan at her personal Washington office, and they delayed releasing the information, and they even threatened to sue a super PAC in court to try and keep these things under the radar, so to speak. But essentially, what happened was William Wilkins, who is the White House IRS chief counsel to the White House, or as people call him, the president's man at the IRS, he personally wrote and hand-stamped a memo to Senator Sheehan, and that memo is now what is in the hands of the D.C. Caller. So there's no getting out of this at this point. And he essentially, you can tell he kind of couched the issue a little bit, and he's trying to be fairly diplomatic here. But he says, in reference to these regulations, which were put in place to direct the way that nonprofit groups are treated by the IRS, these regulations have been in place since 1959, Wilkins wrote. And he said, we will consider proposed changes in this area as we work with tax-exempt and government entities and the Treasury Department's Office of Tax Policy to identify tax issues that could be addressed and designing new regulations and quote-unquote guidance. I hope this information is helpful, Wilkins said. I am sending similar responses to your colleagues. Please have them call me if you have any questions. So it's essentially what we've learned now is that Sheehan got inside information from the IRS, making it very clear she was the point person in a group composed of six Democratic colleagues, including Chuck Schumer, Al Franken, who joined with Sheehan in quietly writing a letter to the then IRS Commissioner Doug Shulman, expressing their concern about how new nonprofit groups were engaging in political activity in 2012. The Democratic senator's publicly available March 9, 2012 letter asked the IRS to quote-unquote immediately change the administrative framework for enforcement of the tax code as it applies to groups designated as social welfare organizations by introducing a new bright line test, and that's a quote also, for how much a tax-exempt group can invest in political activity, and by setting a new rule that at least 51% of a group's activities must be non-political. The senators called for more even more elaborate disclosures about finances and undertakings in the group's Form 990 submissions and sought new rules about how much donors could write off as business expenses. So this is, again, going to explode back onto the scene, I fear, for the IRS. They've done a very good job of keeping this off of the record, you know, trying to pretend that for some strange reason, you know, the only place that your emails are stored on your computer is your hard drive, which is absolute ridiculousness. But I think that now the truth is starting to really come out. We're naming names. There are much more people involved. And I think that what we'll probably end up seeing is that this is going to go all the way up to the top. So that broke yesterday, and that is obviously a pretty significant story. So we will do our best to keep fighting that battle for you guys and keeping bringing you guys the information and letting you know what's going on there. I've got some good news regarding the Navy sailors and the Marines that participated in the cleanup after Fukushima. They have won a major battle in a lawsuit against the government and against TEPCO, GE, Ebasco, Toshiba, and Hitachi. And this ruling just came out yesterday. Right now, it's sort of a small class action lawsuit because it only includes about 200 sailors. But they are alleging that TEPCO's misinformation regarding the Fukushima disaster coaxed American troops and the military to get closer than they should have. And because they essentially lied to them, and now all of these sailors are very, very sick You know, many of them are reporting unexplained cancers, excessive bleeding, thyroid issues. I mean, this is one of these guys who's only 22. After returning from this mission, he started to lose his eyesight. He's lost all of his eyesight in his left eye and some of his right eye. I mean, this is obviously a huge, huge deal. And TEPCO was pushing back really, really hard to try and get this case dismissed. And as of yesterday, the case is not going to be dismissed. So, I, you know, our thoughts and prayers go out to these poor guys that sign up to do these things with the military, thinking they're doing the right thing, and then they're just put in harm's way. And it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. Especially, I mean, think about that. Being 22 years old, you're going over there to do something humanitarian, the best that you can. You're getting bad information, and your reward for that is now blindness and obfuscation by the government and by the corporations involved. It's just, it's ridiculous. And unfortunately, it's par for the course for the treatment of our soldiers, the treatment of our veterans. It's just disgusting. So, that's at least some good news, thinking, you know, that we're moving forward on that. I'd like to, obviously keep up to date on that, and I'll keep you guys up to date when I know more about that. Let's see. This story made me laugh, and it came from Ben Swan. Talking about essentially a recreation of Footloose. Well, not really specifically, but there was a situation that happened at a dance in St. George, Utah, where the city granted these people the right to have a Halloween party. They have a Halloween party every year. They've been doing it for 3 years now, called the Monster Mash. And it's a pretty, you know, sedate, calm, less than 1,000 people type of party. They put in for the permits. They said that they were going to have miniature golf and go-karts, bumper cars, and dancing. So, unfortunately, dancing is not allowed in that city. So city officials require event planners to obtain a permit to hold a public dance. And even though Jared Keddington, the guy who got the permit, said that his permit, the one that he got, his Carby, okayed dancing. They said that city knew that there was going to be dancing. Well, city changed their mind at the last minute, so they sent 6 police officers to make sure that no one was dancing. Now, is this not the most ridiculous use of money? I can't even imagine that there are 6 guys. But they even threatened the DJ, saying that if he played music that inspired people to dance, they would cite him for inciting a riot. So, just goes to show that no matter where you live, there could be someplace much, much worse. And in this particular situation, I was reading this article and I just kept hearing the theme from Footloose over in my head. But it's 2014. I wasn't even aware that there were places that you weren't allowed to dance anymore. But apparently, Utah is one of those places. They sent police, they kept everyone from dancing, and at the end of the day, the party did end early. People asked for refunds. It was kind of a bad deal. So, again, you know, probably not the best use of money in terms of what the police are doing, but there you go. That happened there also. We've got a bunch of stories about voter fraud. I do want to bring your attention to one of those, just because Melissa did such a great job over at TrueStream Media putting together a fantastic example of all of the voter fraud. And there's a lot of people saying, oh, it seems to be mostly the Democrats that are coming out ahead, you know, in the voter fraud. That's not necessarily true. I've seen cases on both sides of the aisle where machines are switching votes one way or the other. And so there are a lot of things. I'm not going to go through the whole article right now, but there are plenty of examples. Again, if you go to redpillreports.com, we have hosted that article in our daily news section, and it is all of the voter fraud. Here it comes, 2014 midterms. Probably quite a bit of that yesterday, unfortunately. I wanted to mention one other story because this is very disheartening to me. Another city in the United States has now declared sharing food as a criminal offense. And this comes down to Fort Lauderdale, ladies and gentlemen. Yesterday, police in Fort Lauderdale detained a 90-year-old man with all of his volunteers for violating a new law that makes sharing food a criminal offense. And let's be clear, these are priests, pastors, mothers, fathers, and everyday citizens. And they're not going around giving out cash or enabling beggars on the side of the highway. They are going around giving ready-to-eat food and genuinely saving starving families that line up for what sometimes amounts to be their only meal on a cold day. And, you know, so this poor guy is 90 years old, out doing the right thing, and that's what we're going to put our police on, you know. So that happened. Looks like he did not end up getting arrested, but he did get cited. So just ridiculous. I encourage everyone to ignore laws like that and absolutely go out and do everything you can to take care of one another. There's no reason to allow a corporation that's masquerading as a city or a county or your state government. You know, your state government was created by the minds of men. At no point in history does that state government become superior to you. And if they're telling you that there are laws on the books that limit your ability to be nice to one another or to take care of yourself, those laws are not valid. That's just the long and the short of it. They're not valid, and I certainly don't consent to any of them. And I keep food in my car to give to homeless people all the time. It's just something that we should all be doing. Because if, you know, at the end of the day, if we don't take care of each other, there's no one that's going to take care of us for us. You know, we need to take care of each other. That's just the right thing to do. So check out that article over at redpillreports.com for all of the voter fraud stuff. And you can also find the article about this poor 90-year-old man who was, intercepted by the police for handing out sandwiches to homeless people. It's just another fantastic indication of the slippery slope that we are on. And a few smaller bits and points of interest, and it's hard for me to even admit this, but the Hollywood Reporter did a fantastic article about former CBS News reporter Cheryl Atkinson's claims that Obama has an enemies list. It's a great interview. I encourage everyone to go read it. But essentially, she can prove beyond the shadow of the doubt that somebody with a very high level of technical ability tapped into her computers while she was at work. Now, who was it? Difficult to say. She's obviously not going to answer that question, but it was definitely somebody. We're going to take another quick 3-minute break here, guys. Stick with us. This is the Red Pill Report for 11.5. We'll be right back. Thanks a lot.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN. Worldwide.
Big business has discovered the preparedness market, and that makes it difficult to know where to go and who to trust. MyPatriotSupply.com is owned and operated by patriots just like you, has the best prices on storable food, non-GMO seeds, water filtration devices, home canning equipment, survival and self-reliance books, and more. MyPatriotSupply.com has old-fashioned values and the absolute best customer service in the industry. Look for the deal of the day, unique, affordable survival supplies that fit anyone's budget. Get same-day shipping on all orders and free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927, 866-229-0927, or visit MyPatriotSupply.com for emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence. Shop with a name you know and a name you can trust. Before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. Wouldn't it be nice to have one product that replaces more than 10, saving you space, time, and money? HempUSA.org has a complete full-spectrum vitamin mineral detox formulation called Micro Plant Powder Gold. Micro Plant Powder Gold contains 101 vitamins, minerals, probiotics, and iodine, has a 100-year shelf life, and is a perfect addition to any storage shelter. Make Micro Plant Powder Gold your choice. Call 888-910-4367 or visit HempUSA.org today.
Evil contains within it the seed of its own destruction.
Truth Warrior with David Whitehead. Mondays on Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the program, ladies and gentlemen. This is, of course, Red Pill Reports, and this is your Red Pill Report for the fifth day of November, the day after Election Day, as it will be going down in history today. I want to remind everybody about our guest at 11 o'clock will be Mr. Matthew Stein. We'll be talking about Ebola and whether or not we should be concerned and whether or not there might be some overlapping type concerns where there could be other issues that we might face where being prepared for Ebola would benefit us in the long run in terms of being prepared for other things as well. And there's nobody I know who is a better explainer, a better descriptor of how to be prepared than Mr. Matthew Stein. So we'll be joining him at 11 o'clock. Appreciate you guys staying with me through the break, and appreciate you guys just being there in general. It's wonderful to be getting some feedback from people, and people seem to be liking the show so far. Of course, if you have feedback and want us to change things or have better ideas, please get to redpillreports.com and send us an email. We're always willing to, as I said, you know, this is going to be a forum for everybody to learn from. We want to provide the best service for all of you that we can provide, which means, you know, anything that I can do to make it better. Had one complaint about the bumpers yesterday not being snazzy enough, so we're going to start working on new bumpers here as soon as we can. There's just a lot on the plate right now, so I appreciate you guys bearing with us as we're moving forward. I always try to get more news than I can possibly cover, and I succeeded majorly yesterday. I didn't realize I had already filled a half an hour with just the national news. So let's get on to the international stuff here really quick. We've got a story about Ebola coming out from Monrovia, Liberia, and apparently the rate of new Ebola infections there has declined so sharply in recent weeks that even some of the busiest treatment facilities are now only half full, and officials are now reassessing the scale of the response needed to quell the epidemic. So we're going to be talking with Matt Stein again a little bit about this later. I was of the opinion that the Ebola issue was being kept out of the news cycle until after yesterday. I'm not sure if that will be the case or if Matt will agree with me there, but this does seem to indicate that perhaps the issue in at least Monrovia, Liberia, is under control. But when I went to Breitbart then, thereafter, I found a different story, and this is coming out of Sierra Leone, which is obviously, you know, one of the other epicenters of this disease. And in Sierra Leone, people are breaking their quarantines. Thousands and thousands of people are not being able to get food delivered to them from aid agencies, because there are, according to these aid agencies, nooks and crannies in the country where they just aren't able to get these people food. And so thousands and thousands of people in Sierra Leone have taken it upon themselves to remove themselves from quarantine. So whether or not that is going to lead to a re-sparking of the Ebola outbreak there remains to be seen. But, you know, again, we're seeing very contradictory stories coming out. We're seeing, you know, one situation that obviously clearly shows the potential for more bad things to happen, and on the other situation in Liberia, things seem to be straightening out over there. So again, we just don't know really what's going on. Matt and I'll try and get a little bit more to the bottom of it today, but 5 days after the World Health Organization said new infections were declining in Liberia, 157-bed treatment center in the city of Foya, where the epidemic began 7 months ago, had no patients. Zero patients on Monday, according to the nurses there. So there might be the silver lining coming down the pipe. I hope that is the case. I cannot imagine living in a country or especially in a place like Monrovia, my goodness, that would be just a, one of the most difficult things to deal with a disease like Ebola. Want to draw some attention to this story about an American grandfather who is now facing 5 years in jail in the United Arab Emirates for taking pictures. And you guys might be a little surprised at what he was taking pictures of, because in the United Arab Emirates, it is illegal to take pictures of embassies and palaces and security facilities, things like that. 3 years ago, an Iranian tourist was sentenced to a month behind bars for taking pictures of the presidential palace. So it is a known thing there. But this gentleman, who is an American professor, he took a picture of a sign banning photography because he thought it was kind of ironic and he hadn't seen one like that before. So he is being detained. His name is Alan Black. He is a doctor. He is being detained without charge in an Abu Dhabi jail after his arrest. And so that's absolutely tragic. And apparently he was in jail for almost a week before anybody in the world knew where he was. And it was only because a translator that was brought in to explain to him why he was being held took pity on him and got in touch with the embassy. The bad thing is that although we are partners with the UAE, there's still quite a bit of, let's say, humanitarian-type concerns about the way prisoners are kept over there. There's been a lot of stories about people who are not fed well and not kept well. So our thoughts and prayers go out, of course, to Dr. Black. You know, let this be an indication to you. If you guys are traveling overseas, or you're someplace where you don't know the lay of the land, sometimes doing that cutesy American, you know, "Oh shucks, I don't know what I'm doing," is just not the right answer. I mean, this gentleman really could end up in jail for the next 5 years, because I don't think that we have any horrible terrorists that we can give back to the UAE being held in Guantanamo right now. And that seems to be the only way that we ever, move towards getting these guys freed. So, we'll keep an eye on this one, too, and let you know what's going on with that poor gentleman. And I've got a follow-up story about all these missing college students that were abducted in Mexico. Right now, as of this weekend, investigators in Mexico have detained the mayor and his wife, who are responsible for this region where these 43 college students were apparently abducted. Now, this President Enrique Nieto, who in the face of public outrage called this case the highest priority as it threatened to overshadow an agenda, he had focused on economic uplift, saluted the police and expressed hope that the arrest would contribute to a decisive way to clearing things up about this investigation. That was a couple of weeks ago. But this has not been the case, apparently. For more than 50 people have been arrested, and they still don't know where these poor children are. So they came after the wife. They have been found hiding in a rundown area, apparently in an abandoned house in the working class district, about 120 miles north of Iguala. And they have been taken under arrest. Another woman who was helping hide them has also been taken into custody. And so I don't know if we're going to get to the bottom of this or not. There have been mass graves discovered. There have been all kinds of people arrested, but The main thing right now is that it has come out that this mayor essentially was concerned that these students were going to disrupt a demonstration that he was going to have, and he told the police to teach them a lesson. And if that turns out to be the case, and the police did take these kids and then turn them over to a drug gang, I don't think that there is a spot in hell worse or bad enough for this mayor and his wife to be put in. So there is that going on also right now internationally. Also in Iran, thousands chant "Down with America" as Iran celebrates its 35th anniversary of the U.S. embassy hostage crisis. This is something, I guess, that takes place every year in Iran, so probably not super duper important, but just goes to show that crowds of people still do gather around the world to chant things like "death to Israel, death to Britain, and death to America" while burning flags of all three of our countries, because we really are imperialistic and we really are not the golden, the golden goose that the world would like us to be or that we pretend that we are. So that's going on in Iran. More turmoil there, unfortunately. And those are the big stories on the international front right now. We have got some economic news in the way of, let's see what these stocks are doing today right now. Let's see here. First and foremost, gold is way down again. 11.46 an ounce for gold right now, down $21, almost 2%, just since yesterday. Silver down to $15.48. That is a 3% change, down almost 50 cents. I'm really looking forward to speaking with some smart financial people coming up in the next few weeks. So somebody might be able to tell me what is going on with gold and what is going on with silver. The Dow Jones is up right now about 61 points. So happy days are still here. We're still well above the $17,000 Dow line. And oil has kind of bounced back up a little bit. We're at that $78.91 mark right now for a barrel of crude. And I think maybe we have now seen a bottom. I think that there were a lot of countries out there. Well, Saudi Arabia especially. I mean, oil, they basically discounted their oil by quite a bit, and I'm thinking that the reason that they did that was to obviously affect Russia, Venezuela, and the Ukraine. So oil prices slumped to multi-year lows yesterday after Saudi Arabia cut the price of oil sold to the United States, and that move is shaking an already volatile market, and it may in turn likely give the world a little bit of an unexpected economic stimulus, because we have seen a 25% drop in the price of oil since summer. And consumer spending and business investment in economies around the world may actually be bolstered from this. But again, the people who are not going to be winning on this one are Russia and Venezuela. And this reminds me of Cold War all over again. This is, you know, the same thing that that the oil producers did back in the late 70s to make it less cost effective for countries like Russia to produce oil and to get it out of the ground. And that's a good way to drive down the value of somebody's economy also, because most of Russia's economy is based on reserves, just based on the idea that they have these vast quantities of oil in the ground ready to go. So by diminishing the value of that in the open market, you take away, you know, from their equity in general. So I think that's why this is all going on. Of course, this is just my own conjecture. You can take it with a grain of salt. And if you have better ideas, please email me and let me know. I'd like to know. Another fantastic article about the U.S. trade deficit coming out on Zero Hedge today. And this one is one that I will get into a little bit because it's not super long. I do recommend everybody go to the news links on our site, because you will be able to see this graph, which I can't really accurately describe other than to say it's all red and it all trends in a downward direction. And there aren't skull and crossbones on it, but if they were there, it would probably fit in pretty well. So we're talking, of course, about the U.S. trade deficit right now, and we are also talking about the currency warfare that, of course, seems to be breaking out between the United States, Europe, and Japan. And what's important to understand is that for every winner, there's also a loser. And in this case, the loser is the one country that has decided that a strong currency is a great thing for its economy, and if only for the time being. And, of course, we're talking about the United States. But the problem with that, however, because in quarter three, the trade deficit rose by 7.6%, which was virtually identical to how much stronger the U.S. dollar basket, the DXY, increased in the same period, which was also 7.7%, which is also the most since Q3 2008 when Lehman Brothers blew up. So why is this so relevant? And again, I want you guys to go and look at this chart, but the U.S. trade, not including petroleum, if you just discount, just take petroleum out of the mix for a second, U.S. trade just tumbled to $48.3 billion, which essentially matches the worst print in the history of the series. This goes back to before Ross Perot even knew what a chart was. Before they can even invented charts, this goes back to worse than that. So this also suggests that the portrayals of the U.S. as a resurgent export powerhouse are absolutely ludicrous, and that instead the U.S. is as big a net importer of goods and services, aside from the shale revolution, of course, as it ever has been. And the other side of this coin is that if and when the Saudi crude crunch finally starts taking out shale capacity, which will be slow at first and then probably start building up in speed, I want you guys to watch how the headline trade balance line and the X the Line X oil slowly start to converge as the U.S. reverts to its status as the world's biggest net importer once again. The biggest question on the table, however, is how much longer will the Fed stand on the sideline and pretend not to notice that once again the surging U.S. dollar, you know, because obviously they'll never do QE again, is about to crash the economy yet again. And woe to the spinners in the mainstream media this winter if we do not have a heavy snowfall or an awful winter on which to blame the resultant GDP collapse. So one thing Tyler Durden believes over at Zero Hedge is certain is that if the trade deficit surge does continue and Q3 GDP tumbles to like 1% or less, we will see the Fed right back on the tow line again, pushing QE and ready to start printing money again. They'll be firing up the presses. And I 100% completely agree with that. So, we'll keep an eye on that. Everything is, all interconnected. I want to mention too that we are going to have, V, the Gorilla Economist on Friday. So that should be an absolutely outstanding show. If you're interested in, underground economics, you'll want to tune in at the 11 o'clock hour for that show for sure. In Bitcoin news, BitPay, launches a Bitcoin checkout app for one-tap payments, similar to the Apple Pay. But this particular one is obviously going to, work for, Bitcoin. And this is the latest move by BitPay in launching a new point of sale application. It's for Android and iPhone. And this launch happened at the 2020, in Las Vegas at the Money 2020 conference that just took place a couple of weeks ago. And a Bitcoin payment solution is now available in 40 different languages, includes multi-employee checkout, tipping, and tip reporting. And the checkout app is available for Android, as I said, and will soon roll out to the, Apple market. We're very excited about this, according to BitPay, because it uses near-field communication, which allows shoppers to use their mobile phones near each other without actually having to be wired. It's the same way that, Bluetooth works and things like that. But it opens up another opportunity for BitPay to start allowing people to use and accept Bitcoin at many different merchants around the world. I think that Bitcoin is still, is still in the infancy phases, but I think that with the announcement yesterday of crazy new efficient cloud computing capability coming out of Germany, and also with the recent announcements of PayPal accepting or at least getting ready to work with vendors so that they can accept Bitcoin, not to mention the large corporations out there like Dish Network that accept Bitcoin, I think that this thing is going to be on the move. I'm really hoping that Bitcoin will continue to grow, because I do think, from an international standpoint, it is a solution. And it's a solution to a problem that we actually have a really big need to solve, which is, the largest Ponzi scheme ever in the history of the planet, which is the Federal Reserve and the fractional reserve lending system. And anything we can do to get away from that, I am down for. So, that will cover our economic news for the day. I'm going to jump over into some tech stuff here, just because there are some interesting developments going on in the world of tech. Probably the thing that I am most concerned about is a new microchip coming out from a company called Emoshape. You can find their website at emospark.com. Of course, the link is at redpillreports.com under the show links. But this Emoshape has announced the launch of a major technology breakthrough with something they are calling an EPU, or an Emotional Processing Unit. This patent-pending technology creates a synthesized emotional response in machines that are capable of artificial intelligence. I'm just going to say that again. This machine, this microchip, this emotional processing unit, is designed to create an emotional response in artificial intelligent machines, you guys. That cannot be good, right? I mean, this can't be good. So it's based on the 8 primary emotions, which were identified by Robert Plutchik's psychoevolutionary theory, which uses groundbreaking EPU algorithms, effectively enabling machines to respond to stimuli in line with one of the 8 primary emotions: anger, fear, sadness, disgust, surprise, anticipation, trust, and joy. And this is the first time in the history of the universe, as far as we know, at least in our universe, that science and technology industry has tried to empower machines to respond to human emotions with human emotions. Again, I'm not super duper pumped on this. I think that this is obviously, I've seen Terminator. I know where this is going. This is the first step in a machine becoming self-aware and deciding that maybe, emotionally, it's not really as attached to us as a species as it wants to be or as it's supposed to be. The U.S. and London-based company is now set to launch the production of these first AI home console units in time for Christmas of 2014. That's like a month, you guys. The first product is something called the Emo Spark. It is a cube. It fits in the palm of your hand with the purpose of being a digital friend. Wow. We're talking, I mean, every sentence I read just is like, moving further down the slippery slope. So this thing, this cube, is going to monitor your facial expressions and emotions by capturing images through an external camera. The images are then processed until the cube can recognize who the person using it is and their relationship to others. It will also monitor users' responses to the world around them with a focus on the user's reaction to music. I can't even imagine what the next step for something like this is going to be. You know, we talked yesterday extensively about countervalence and about all the corporations out there that are attempting to cultivate information from you. But one of the main places they're not able to get information is about your emotional state, about what it is that actually drives you to make decisions. And that's obviously the holy grail if you're a company like, you know, Google or whoever that wants to market products to people. If they can figure out how to control or how to interpret your emotions, I mean, if they have a live device sitting in your living room that knows who you are and your react, you know, your... It's they're essentially building a spy to put in your home. So that's going to happen. Emo shape, keep an eye out for that. Don't get me one for Christmas. That's my request on that. And in other interesting news, I should probably let everybody know that I am a watch fanatic. I think that, you know, I came out of an engineering background. So for me, small mechanical devices that are precise are very, very cool. But this takes the cake for precise. There has been a new record-breaking atomic clock invented that is so precise that it neither loses nor gains a second in 5 billion years, which is longer, you know, according to some, than the age of the Earth. I mean, that's insane. This is the most accurate clock that's ever been produced. It's already gotten the Guinness Book of World Records, right? But the clock is so strong and so powerful, it actually can show the effects of gravity on time. The clock was developed in the United States at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics by a team from NIST and the University of Colorado. And what's really crazy about this is that the group leader, Dr. Yun Yi, says this was unveiled in Nature earlier this year. We already have plans to push the performance even farther. He says this, in sense, is really just a midterm report. He says, you can expect more breakthroughs in our clocks over the next 5 to 10 years. In terms of stability, the new clock equals the performance of the NIST world-leading Yttrebrum atomic clock. But this particular clock keeps time by means of atoms oscillating between two energy levels. So the strontium lattice clock, which is what this one is, a few thousand atoms of strontium are held in a column of laser elliptical traps. And this scientist say that this clock ticks, if you could call it a tick, 430 trillion times every second by bathing these atoms in a very stable red light laser. I don't really know why we would need to be more accurate than this, but they're moving on becoming more accurate than that. So that's, you know, that's happening also. Facebook sees a 24% uptick in government requests for user data over the last year. Being the largest social network, Facebook is one of the prime feeding grounds for data and inevitability requests from federal agencies for said data. According to Facebook's latest transparency report, which was published yesterday, the California-based company received 34,946 requests for data during the first 6 months of 2014, which translates to a 24% uptick from the second half of 2013. So, what is cool about this is that, well, I don't know if it's cool about it or not, but Chris Sonderby, who is the Facebook's deputy general counsel, promised in the report that the company pushes back very hard against any and all requests for forking over any data, if they actually fork any data over at all. I'm going to take that with a grain of salt because I know Facebook is probably not most up and up in terms of what it is that they're doing with our data. I want to move on to some health news really quick because there's a fantastic story that came out of, let's see, where did this come out of? GreenMed Info, which is a fantastic website. But I was actually eating a piece of pizza when I read this yesterday, and this entire article is about how eating wheat and cow's milk can disrupt DNA expression and your antioxidant status. I'd recommend everybody go and read this, but it's talking about how not only are there anecdotal evidence for health concerns about gluten and casein, which is the protein in cheese, having an effect on you, but now there are starting to see some significant real life published case studies talking about how those two, you know, very common ingredients in American food, if not the cornerstone of the American food diet, really, as I'm sitting here eating a piece of pizza yesterday while I'm reading that, can affect people in terms of autism, schizophrenia, all kinds of horrible things that they're starting to really tie these things together. So I want everyone to go check out that article. There's another fantastic one that came out of The Independent talking about shift work and how shift work can have a very negative effect on your mental ability. So I would recommend everybody go there also. I myself used to work 12-hour days and be bounced back and forth between night and day for weeks at a time. And now they're showing pretty specifically that that can cause long-term mental cognition issues. It can lead to things like cancer just your circadian rhythms alone being disrupted can really lead to cancer. Guys, I tried my best today to get through all the news. I've crashed and burned, as I usually do, but I do not mind because there are places where you can now go. If you go to Red Pill Reports, you can see the rest of the news from the day. We are going to be zooming off to a 3-minute break, and then when we come back, we're going to be joined by Matthew Stein. We're going to be talking about Ebola and preparedness and all the things that we probably don't know and should know about that. So do me a favor, stay right here, support Truth Frequency, go see the website. We're going to be back in just about 3 minutes. Thanks for staying here, guys. I'm JD Moore. This is your Red Pill for today, your daily dose of deprogramming.
Haven't you always wanted your very own Truth Frequency Radio bumper sticker? To get the word out about the fastest growing news talk outlet in the independent media? Joe Joseph here for TruthFrequencyRadio.com. KTFRN and LibertyStickers.com have teamed up to give you your very own Truth Frequency Radio bumper sticker for free. Just go to TruthFrequencyRadio.com/stickers today. And don't forget to visit our friends at LibertyStickers.com, home of the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. Their vast selection and quality of stickers are second to none. TruthFrequencyRadio.com, because silence is consent.
Judith Baker was once a promising science student who dreamed of finding a cure for cancer. This exposé is an account of how she strayed from a path of mainstream scholarship to a life of espionage in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald. In her narrative, she offers extensive documentation on how she came to be a cancer expert and what led to her involvement in the development of a biological weapon that Oswald was to smuggle into Cuba to eliminate Fidel Castro. Details on what she knew of Kennedy's impending assassination and her belief that Oswald was a deep cover intelligence agent who was framed for an assassination he was actually trying to prevent are also revealed. Me and Lee by Judith Baker. Special JFK 50th Anniversary Signed Limited Edition. $30 including shipping. Limited number of these available. Order your copy today at federaljack.com/store.
Doctors don't want you to know about iodine because it allows the body to heal itself quickly and permanently. Iodine Now is a complete powder formulation that will load iodine into the body with vitamin C for the best possible absorption. Iodine Now, available by the case. And for protection from radiation, fluoride, chlorine, and bromine, including all heavy metals. We believe that this is the main element that humans need more than any other at this time. This formulation is infused with our bioactive aerobic rare earth nutrient powder that has a powerful negative charge that attracts positive toxins. Why not buy one product that does the job of 20 and saves you space, time, and money, has a storage life of 100 years, all for about $18 a month. Call 888-910-4367 or visit hempusa.org. Call 888-910-4367. Bringing back the universal medicine for mankind. Iodine Now. Only at hempusa.org.
Real people. Real radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR. Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to your Red Pill Report. Today, ladies and gentlemen, my name is J.D. Moore. We are, of course, live Monday through Friday, and we're moving into the second hour of our broadcast today on this fifth day of November. And we are very, very happy to be joined by Mr. Matthew Stein today. And for those of you who don't know, Mr. Matthew Stein is a design engineer, a green builder. He's the author of two best-selling books. One was When Disaster Strikes, which is a comprehensive guide to emergency planning and crisis survival, which is kind of the pre-apocalypse book, so to speak. And then he also wrote When Technology Fails, which is a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long-term emergencies if in the event that they do happen, which is essentially how to be MacGyver in case things go very, very wrong. He's also actually put out a new children's story called Geronimo the Frog also, which I have yet to read, but I hear wonderful things about. He's a graduate of MIT, where he majored in mechanical engineering. Needless to say, gentleman is exceptionally smart. He's appeared on many, many radio and television programs. He's a repeat guest on Fox News, MSNBC, Coast to Coast. He's been on Alex Jones's show, and he's been on the Tom Hartman show. He's also personally an active mountain climber, serves as a guide and instructor for blind skiers, and has written several articles on the subject of sustainable living. And he's also a guest columnist for the Huffington Post. We are super excited to have him here. And as I said earlier in the broadcast, he's essentially an outdoor mountaintop version of MacGyver. And Matt, do you think that's a pretty fair description of you, my friend?
Reasonably, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was one of those little kids who's always taking his toys apart. Of course, when I was 5 years old, they wouldn't go back together very well, but,
right.
But I love to see how things worked and what made things tick, and I guess that's why I ended up being an engineer.
Well, I think that's probably a fair, reasonable, pursuit to go down for somebody who likes to take things apart. Is there anything else in your background that you feel like everyone out there needs to know before we start getting into the nitty-gritty of self-preparedness and what's going on around the world?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting background because I've been in alternative healings. I kind of had a miraculous healing of a friend of mine through a meditative technique. Who was crippled all the way through high school. She'd been in a wheelchair for a couple of years, and then she walked with leg braces and a cane. So to do a meditative visualization technique for her remotely that I had no faith in, and she had no even idea I was doing it, and it healed her, and that kind of blew my mind. I was a freshman at MIT at the time, and it really went totally against the grain of my MIT science-based, you know, action, reaction, physics, biochemistry, model of the universe.
Right.
So it sort of started me looking in other directions that opened my eyes that things in the world might not always be the way they perceived. So I've been open to, homeopathy and herbs and various healing things. I've had experiences with antibiotic resistant infections years ago, and my wife that, weren't responding to drugs that did respond well to homeopathy and herbs. So, and colloidal silvers, things like that. So, I'm a very hands-on kind of person. I grew up hunting and fishing in Vermont and hiking, and you know, the White Mountains and Green Mountains and Adirondacks are my four-season playgrounds. And then after I graduated, I moved out to the West Coast where the real mountains were. And so I'm a hands-on kind of guy. I'm not a behind-the-desk sort of engineer. I'm a real hands-on outdoors kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. And it's really evident when you pick up either of the books that you've written. I have to say, you know, I'm into self-reliance, and I wouldn't call myself a prepper, but I definitely have, you know, a go bag in my house for 36 hours. I've got go bag stuff in my car that's for 72. And if I could get a combo of those two things together, I would probably be okay. But when I approached my good friend, I've got another good friend who's really into survival and self-prep, and said, what books are out there that you would recommend to have in a bug out bag? And without even missing a beat, he said, When Technology Fails. So I went out and I got it. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this book, and I don't sell this book. You can't get it on my website. You've got to go see whentechfails.com to go get it from Matt. But this thing is a tome, Matt, which leads me to believe that this is probably only a small amount of what's in your mind. But this is over 450 pages of, I mean, this is how to survive, how to do absolutely everything from preparing food to conserving water to, you know, everything you could possibly want to know when you don't have technology to use. And that, it's just such a remarkable thing. And I'm so happy to be an owner of that book and somebody who can promote you into doing that.
Well, it's also about like living sustainably and self-reliantly while the world is still working well. You know, how can you be healthier? You know, how can you take more charge for your health and the quality of your life and your living? And, you know, so it's kind of half before, you know, what hits the fan, and half for after, you know, what hits the fan. So, it's and people ask me, they say, well, you know, why would an MIT engineer write a book called When Technology Fails? I mean, you guys are supposed to like worship technology, right? I mean, isn't Steve Jobs supposed to be like my god? And no. But I'd had a 20-year practice, now mostly 30-year practice of prayer and meditation that started in between my junior and senior year at MIT when I was an engineering intern at Plantronics, the headset people in Santa Cruz, and I ended up having a phenomenal spiritual experience with a 108-year-old Indian yogi. And so after that, I just started a daily practice, not fanatical, prayer and meditation. And sometimes when I'd have real difficult engineering problems I'm banging my head against the wall on and not happy with any solutions I could figure out with my mind, I'd pray and I'd ask for help and I'd meditate, and pictures snapped into my head with solutions to the problem that were better than I could just figure out through the normal process. Well, in 1999, I made a very generic request during my morning session of prayer and meditation. I just simply asked for guidance and inspiration, you know, like just generic.
Right.
No particular problem I was focusing on, nothing I was particularly thinking about. And after I asked that, I got this bomb dropped in my lap. I got this roughly 30-page pictorial, three-dimensional storyboard outline for this massive book project just instantly dumped into my head. Now, realize that writing was not my strong suit at MIT. I mean, I was great with math and science, and writing I was decent, but it, you know, it took work. The other stuff didn't take much work on my part. And, you know, a term paper in college was like a major ordeal for me, and this was like, you know, 100 term papers in one dumped into my head instantly and fully organized. Now, my first thought was no effing way. I mean, I don't know all this stuff. And Jesus calls it the still small voice. The little voice of spirit in my head said, instantly replied and said, well, nobody knows it all.
Wow.
And it assured me that I had the skills and talents that if I chose to take the assignment on, and it always felt much more like my assignment than my idea. It never felt like my idea. It felt more like my cosmic homework assignment,
right,
that if I chose to take it on, that I get the inner and outer help I needed to complete the project. That I didn't just jump right up and say, well, you know, God talked to me today and showed me this real cool book to help mankind out during the coming, you know, trials and tribulations. It was like, took me about a year to decide maybe it was a good idea and I could do it. And I ran the idea by a couple friends or writers, and and by how, and I dug up Howard Rheingold, who took over from Stuart Brand as the editor of the Whole Earth catalog, and he thought it was a great idea. And then I took another year to write a proposal and, you know, 200-page proposal and 3 sample chapters and find a small publisher, and it gave me a modest advance. And then another year to work 70 hours a week, you know, 7 days a week and rack up the credit cards while I put my engineering business on hold and, you know, finish it off and make it happen. So it was about 3 years from the time I got the blast from above till I actually made the first edition, and that was 19, so it came out in, around Thanksgiving of 2000, so I missed Y2K, so I didn't do it for Y2K, but I missed it. If I'd had it out before then, I would have made a lot of money, but, you know, as it was, my small publisher was on the verge of bankruptcy and never paid me, so it was a huge loss. Until I finally broken even, so I probably made about 10 cents an hour on the book instead because, you know, I got a second publisher and I put another year's worth of labor into updating it in 2008 and, you know, really expanded it a lot and updated it a lot. So it's been a labor of love, certainly not something I could eat on or, you know, feed my family on.
Well, and, you know, the 2 points that strike me about that, you know, what you just said, were, first of all, isn't it remarkable how when you're capable of something that somehow and sometimes the universe will put you in a position where you're, you know, obligated to use your capability for the greater good. And I think that's what we've seen here. Obviously, you got the big data dump into your brain because you were capable of understanding it, even if it took you a couple years to really bring it to fruition. You didn't shortcut anything in this book, my friend. There are not a lot of pictures. I mean, it's chock-a-block full of words. This is a big book, and there's a lot of information in it. And as I said, man, this is a staple for the bug-out bag going forward. But I'm very thankful that you were in a position to put this out because, like you said also, is that you were not, you didn't have it out for Y2K. But isn't it amazing how threats similar to Y2K keep popping up, you know? So, you know, right now, obviously, the big thing on everybody's mind is Ebola, and I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I've been working on it in the background for a few months now, but I would love to hear your impression of just where we are right now, nationally and internationally, with this Ebola thing, and what we can learn from it going forward.
Well, I think, when I first, let's kind of backtrack a little on the Ebola thing, and I'll okay. start, you know, My wife passed on last year, and I have a new girlfriend, and she's a nurse practitioner, and who also has a very strong background in alternative healing and massage therapy and naturopathic clinics she's worked in, and she said last summer, early in the summer, she said, you know, this Ebola thing's really scary because people who know how to deal with Ebola in Africa are getting sick and dying. Caregivers are getting sick and dying. The number 1 and 2 doctors in Liberia died. Dr. Sheikh Kumar, I've forgotten his full name, but he was one of the world experts on Ebola and treating Ebola, and he got Ebola and died, and his chief nurse got Ebola and died, and the other top doctor in Liberia who was treating people got Ebola and died. So she said, this is serious, and this is going to be really big, and they're missing an opportunity to squash it when it was still fairly small, mm-hmm. which were all true. So one of the first things I did was I thought, like, okay, how serious is this? Well, Ebola is a blood-borne virus, a body fluid-borne virus is what everybody's telling us. So I said, okay, let's think of a couple of other body fluid-borne viruses that are out there, and let's see, you know, where this Ebola might go, you know. So first I started with AIDS, and, you know, it turns out that AIDS has something like a 2 to 8 year incubation period on the average, you know. And it's not very easily transmittable, and the AIDS epidemic has been growing since probably undetected in the 1960s, was first detected and isolated around 1980, somewhere in the Reagan years. Right. And now there's about 32 million people worldwide with AIDS, okay? And that seems like a big number, but it's like less than 0.5% of the world's population. So, you know, which is still significant. So I thought, okay, that's pretty serious, but, you know, it's like how many people do you know who are dying of AIDS? Not that many. You know, like, I don't know anybody. I mean, I've known of people who died of AIDS, but I don't know anybody. So it's not that worrisome. Okay, so let's look at another body fluid-borne virus. So I looked up hepatitis. Mm-hmm. And what I found about hepatitis is pretty shocking, that something like one in eight, one in ten people in the world has viral hepatitis now.
Really?
And, yeah, one in ten. Let me see. I've got my paper that I was working on right here. And so let me just pull out the real stat. And it's like, the real stat is, let's see. Okay. Yeah, viral hepatitis, 1 in 12. Oh, I'm sorry, it wasn't 1 in 10, it's 1 in 12. 8% of the world's population now is living with chronic viral hepatitis. That's more than 500 million people. Hmm. And then I thought, okay, well, how infectious is hepatitis versus Ebola? You know, what's, and so I talked to my friend, the nurse practitioner, and she'd been at the VA for 6 months in Oregon, and she, Mary, said, yeah, I said, well, do you know of any healthcare workers who've ever gotten hepatitis from one of their patients? And she says, no, I don't know of any. Have you heard of any? She said, no, I haven't heard of any. I'm sure there are some in America who've gotten hepatitis from their patients. But not only does she not personally know of any, and she's been in the healthcare business for, you know, over 20 years, then mm-hmm. she's never even heard of any. Now, so then look at Ebola, and it's like, wow, when... Now, here's the good news, bad news on Ebola. The bad news is that it appears to be far more infectious than viral hepatitis, which has slowly crept into 1 in 12 people on the entire planet Earth. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, so that's pretty bad news. You know, the good news about it is that it appears that they're making headway against it in Liberia. That they are knocking it down, that, you know, you don't know for sure, but it appears that the influx of education, people are stopping doing voodoo and, you know, denying that Ebola exists in Liberia, which happened for quite a while, right. And they're following in the footsteps of, of Nigeria, and they're educating, and they've got a lot of Western help that's in there now, and it appears that the number of burials each week is dropping and that the number of new cases is dropping. So that's showing us that they can conquer with the right, you know, education in dealing with it properly, they can conquer it. So let's look at like this, the case of the man who brought Ebola. I'll talk about the case of a man, Duncan, Mr. Duncan, who brought Ebola to the United States. Mm-hmm. And also the case of, a guy who brought it into Nigeria. He was an American Liberian businessman, and he brought it to Nigeria. And I've been focusing on engineering the last couple of weeks, so all of these things that were heavy in my brain have kind of, okay, Patrick Sawyer, that's the guy's name. Okay, so Mr. Patrick Sawyer last summer on July 20th, American businessman Patrick Sawyer brought Ebola to Nigeria. So basically, he'd been caring for, oh wow, I got a buck with a big rack that just walked in front of my office.
Do you need to take a minute?
No, that's okay. They come by all the time, but,
well, that's cool.
Oh, my dog just saw it. My dog charged it, and the buck stood its ground and lowered its horns, and my dog turned around.
Yeah, smart dog.
It's like, okay, you didn't run. It's used to the deer running, and this deer didn't run. So it was like, I don't think I want to face off with those horns.
Yeah, no.
So the deer's just sitting there staring at me, and my dog turned and walked away. So. Yeah, it's like they're much more fun when they run, she said. Yeah, so anyway, yeah, it's got a pretty good sized rack. I don't know, 6 points, 8 points, something like that.
Wow.
You know, yeah, anyway, a little diversion there. Okay, so Mr. Sawyer was he was a businessman. He had some contacts in the government, and he was feeling a little sick, and there was a conference on business development that was going on in Nigeria they wanted to take part in. So he got someone in the government to allow him to get on the plane. You know, he pulled some strings and got on a plane. And he got really ill in the final flight of his leg to Lagos. And so it turns out that even though he's feeling really sick on the last of the multi-leg flight, and that's Lagos, Nigeria, which is a city of 21 million people. I mean, a huge city.
Huge city. Yeah.
So he got very sick on the plane, and the good news is that even though he was in the really sick stage of Ebola, not a single person on the plane, not a stewardess, not a passenger next to him, nobody on the plane got Ebola. However, two of the people who he was, when he got in, tried to get into a taxi, he was quite ill. Two people who helped him into the taxi did get Ebola. And the nurse that cared for him in the hospital also got Ebola. Now, here's the caveat. The nurse gave him an IV. She had a cut on her arm and some fluids, you know, from him got into her cut. She wasn't gowned up. She wasn't doing anything in particular. She wasn't worried about Ebola. She wasn't told that Ebola might be a concern. Mr. Sawyer denied that Ebola might be a concern. And so there was total lack of care or precaution or protection on the people around him. And so it wasn't until he was extremely sick and being hospitalized that he started infecting people with Ebola. And that appears to be the case. So if you look at Mr. Duncan, who brought Ebola to this country, now there's conflicting stories. The story from people in Africa is that Mr. Duncan's landlord's daughter was pregnant and not feeling well.
Right.
And that Duncan and the woman's younger brother both helped her into the car, spent 3 hours with her at the hospital, and they had no rooms and no space for her and turned her away.
Right.
And then they carried her. She was no longer able to walk. She was so sick by that time. So Mr. Duncan and the brother carried her back into a taxi and brought her back home, and then she died. I think she died either on the way home or when she got back home. She died shortly thereafter.
So that's major exposure. I mean,
right.
Carrying
and
somebody
so,
who just can't walk, obviously.
And so both Duncan and the younger brother also got Ebola and eventually also died.
Right.
And so it was, but nobody, basically until she was so sick that she was headed for the hospital, I don't think anyone, any contact with her got Ebola. And so that's mostly what people are seeing, is that until someone is not only just got a light fever, but like really riddled with Ebola to where they're starting to have diarrhea and vomiting and perhaps bleeding, like, you know, 40% or something like that have bleeding that might come out of their eyes or their nose. But almost everybody at that stage at least is diarrhea and vomiting. So it's when the Ebola is like riddled the body and they're really full of it and their body fluids are starting to leak a lot. That's when they're like extremely infectious. And that's where you need the space suits, and that's where you need to use extreme caution, and you have to have an N95 mask that seals really, really well, or a respirator. That's when extreme care is warranted. So the fears of like, oh my God, this person had a mild fever and got on a plane or got on, you know, this person who later came down with Ebola got on a plane and got on a city bus. The chances appear, and I'm not, you know, it's not definitive, the chances appear to be extremely slim for getting Ebola in that situation. And given that case that, like, in Nigeria, one of the nurses who got Ebola from the Rick Sacra, the Patrick Sawyer, the businessman who went to the conference and brought Ebola to Nigeria, there was one of the nurses got sick and she went into her congregation in church and they prayed over her and held hands in her and did all of this, and not one of those people got Ebola. And so this woman was clearly sick at that time and not one of those people got it. So it appears to be like only really scarily infectious when you're in the final stages, when body fluids are leaking and when you're like extremely sick and ready for the hospital. So that's the good news. The other good news is that in Nigeria, they had a Bill Gates and Melinda Foundation hospital that had been devoted to, it's the disease that was like really big in...
Marburg or...
No, not Marburg. No, it's a much more common disease. It's in diarrhea and it's in fluids. It's in waterborne disease. And anyway, it was a hospital developed to fight that. It was, you know, the big earthquake over there. The workers. It's a common disease, begins with an H. I'm just spacing on it right now, but it common disease. Anyway, this hospital was already set up to deal with tropical diseases and that, and so they very quickly switched it over to being an Ebola center, and so they were in the very rapidly developed means to track people. So here it is. It Ebola is out in a city of 21 million people.
Right.
In the third world, in Nigeria, and yet they had the systems in place to jump on it, and they tracked people, and they did isolation of people, and they stopped it. They have not had a new case of Ebola in a couple months now, or in more than 2 months. It's like 3 months now. I think it was the end of July, end of August or something was the last time they had a new case in Nigeria. So they jumped on it and they squashed it before it went out of hand. Just think how much cheaper and easier it would have been in Liberia if they'd done the same kind of thing. But Liberia, it has been a war-torn country. It was kind of like a perfect place for Ebola to take off because it had had civil war, it had been war-torn, people didn't trust the government, they had total distrust of the government, so any kind of government actions where they were very suspicious and they didn't tend to want to go along with them. So they had this slum, called West Point in Nigeria, in the big city.
Monrovia.
In Monrovia.
Right.
And it got loose in the slum, and so it was like the perfect storm to grow for Ebola to grow. So the question then kind of comes down to, like, okay, what's the chances of it coming to America? And I would say it's going to be somewhat endemic in Africa now, and the chances are quite good that it will spread into other countries of Africa just from people moving around. I mean, it was kind of a border area between Guinea and Guinea, all the different countries in there, Liberia and Guinea and the other one, the Sierra Leone. You know, those three, it was right around the border. And so people were freely traveling between the borders, and that's why it really spread quite easily amongst those countries. So the chances are that you're going to have this pool of Ebola in the population there, and some people will get it and they won't. You know, they'll never get very sick, and then it won't have bad symptoms. Apparently, in the local population, there's about 10% of the population have antibodies for Ebola. So it's been something that's there, and it just has normally been squashed in the villages and never
right.
gotten out of here.
We've got to run to a break. I hate to cut you off. We've got 3 minutes. We'll be right back when that's done.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN. Worldwide.
Time and time again.
You need to come here and help us. We need assistance. Please.
Those we should be able to depend on let us down.
Federal and state and local officials saying help is on the way. Well, the folks here in Bell Harbor say show me.
Don't depend on the government to save you. Take action now so that you're prepared for the next disaster with MyPatriotSupply.com. Get the best prices on storable food, non-GMO seeds, water filtration devices, home canning equipment, survival and self-reliance books, and more at MyPatriotSupply.com. Call 866-229-0927.
We are hurting down here, and we need help immediately.
Before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Since our founding in 2005, we at YouTube have continually strived to bring you the best possible video experience on the internet. But now, we're updating YouTube to make it even better and give our users more of what they want. Introducing YouTube Plus, the new and improved version of YouTube. We're bringing a whole bunch of great new additions to YouTube.
Over the years, we've noticed that a large amount of copyrighted material is uploaded by our users, which is not okay with us. So we've revamped our content identification system to make it so if you even so much as steal a quote or use a line from a movie or TV show, your video will immediately be taken down.
And finally, in order to reduce our bandwidth costs and make videos even cheaper for us to host, we've made it so that videos will always play in the lowest possible quality, 240p. This way, everyone can enjoy fast video speeds and barely average video quality.
YouTube Plus. What are you gonna do about it?
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Down the rabbit hole with Popeye, Tuesday through Friday,
Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Red Pill Report program for the 5th of November. We are speaking with Mr. Matthew Stein right now, and we are currently undergoing our daily dose of deprogramming as we try to figure out what the real ramifications of this Ebola pandemic are going to be, or if there are going to be any of those at all. Matt, before the break, we had kind of gone over some of the good news regarding Ebola. I'm wondering if there are any points that you would make on the opposite side of that coin, on the bad news side.
Well, the bad news side is that our country has privatized the healthcare system tremendously in the last, you know, since the Reagan era. And what that means is that it's a for-profit healthcare system now, and so they, by doing that, it's kind of like just-in-time delivery on you know, in industry. It means that there's like no slack built into the system, because slack is like wasted profit.
Wasted overhead, really.
Yeah, wasted overhead. So essentially, we've got the system, which is kind of running at like 98% right now. And so it doesn't have much room for, you know, much slack time. So, for instance, we had this recent virus, Enterovirus 68. And that caused hospitals that hadn't turned away an ambulance in 10 years, you know, were turning away ambulances multiple times because they simply had no more space in their emergency room and in their care facilities for these small children who are coming in with severe respiratory distress. Now, the E68 was a nasty virus, and it killed at least one kid, and I think there's four or five that died, and there may have been more since then. It's kind of quieted down. Oh. But what that showed us was that this, you know, virus, which is nowhere near as deadly as Ebola by a long shot, totally overloaded the system in a bunch of cities where this was going on, where kids who were having severe respiratory trauma had no place to go. They're getting turned away at one emergency room after another. And so given that, we have a similar situation where, you know, especially imagine if two things hit at once. Say you had like E68 and Ebola all of a sudden hitting at once. Then suddenly you're in a situation similar in some respects to Africa, where there simply weren't enough beds, not enough healthcare workers, and so people were being turned away. And then what happens is that, you know, with Ebola, the big danger is when somebody hits this stage where they're really sick. Then pretty much, you know, a large percentage of the people who handle and touch. You know, family members, healthcare workers, a large percentage of them get sick with Ebola if they're not, like, covered with a bunny suit. I mean, you even saw in America, you've seen a couple of nurses who had the protective gear. They weren't highly trained in the use of it, like the nurses in the few isolation facilities in the country. Like people, you know, Dr. Richard Sacra, who was working in Liberia, and he was actually delivering babies in a hospital. He wasn't dealing with Ebola victims, and he realized he had a fever, he had Ebola symptoms, he isolated himself, and then he got himself tested right away, and he found he did have Ebola, and eventually they isolated him and transferred him to the United States. And they sent him to the hospital in Nebraska, in Omaha. Mm-hmm. And that is like, they had like enough people, enough beds. That's the biggest isolation unit in the country, and they could handle 10 people.
Yeah, they've got an entire West Nile isolation ward there, I think, at Lincoln.
Right, mm-hmm. And they can handle 10, okay? And that's the biggest in the country. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing is that, yes, you know, when there's a few Ebola people, a few people with Ebola at the same time, then our system is designed and can handle it quite well. And you saw that these nurses who did come down with it, who were treated right away or watched carefully, did survive. You know, they're not dying at a 50% rate. They're done. You know, some people who've been treated in the West still died. You know, the Spanish nurse who had Ebola, that he got from a priest who'd been in Liberia treating them, he died. Mm-hmm. The African Doctors Without Borders doctor who was treated in the EU for Ebola that he got while he was working treating people in Liberia, he died. So some Western medical workers receiving Western medical care do die, but it's at a much lower percentage rate than the 70% fatality rate in Liberia. But the truth is that outside of those critical care isolation facilities with highly trained people in this country, the rest of the healthcare workers are not that well trained with how to deal with this, and we saw that with a couple of people in Houston, you know, or Dallas, getting getting Ebola, mm-hmm. And you know they didn't die, but they did get Ebola from their patients, and that's when the patients are really infectious, is by when they get to the hospital or when they get turned away from the hospital. So we have the potential in this country; it certainly could crop up and suddenly overload the system. And I'm hoping that will not be the case. I mean, it's looking like they're getting a handle on it. It's looking like that won't be the case. But it could be. And so one of the things that I have this list of healing remedies in a chapter in When Disaster Strikes on, you know, what to do when high-tech medicine fails. You know, in the next, how do you keep your family healthy when the next pandemic happens? If the medicines aren't working, or B, they're not available, you know, and when a pandemic happens and it's overloading the system, then certainly your access to regular Western medicines is not going to be, it's going to be gone. It's going to disappear in a hurry. Like in 1919 with the Spanish flu epidemic that killed 50 to 100 million estimated worldwide, in 2 years' time, it killed more people than all of World War I and World War II put together.
Right.
And that was a flu that guys brought back with them to America in the military, who were fighting in World War I, brought this back, and then it spread all over America. I guess, you know, supposedly they brought it back to Spain, and then it spread all around the world. And we're in a situation now where there's a lot more travel and there's a lot more potential for that. Now, luckily, you know, then we can talk about the question of airborneness with Ebola. And so it turns out, you know, people say, well, Ebola is only infectious through body fluids, but it turns out it appears to be that it's infectious also through airborne aerosols. You know, if somebody's at the latter stages of Ebola, where their body is riddled with the virus, then just simply sneezing, and a sneeze can spread these aerosols like 10, 15 feet away.
Right.
So it's conceivable that you could get sick on an airplane from somebody sneezing with Ebola. Now, the good news is that Mr. Sawyer, who brought Ebola from Liberia to Nigeria, was sick on the plane in the last leg. He was quite sick, and not a single person on the plane got ill. But two people who helped him into the taxi and somebody who helped him at the hospital did get Ebola. So, you know, so here's the proof that aerosols can do this. There was a study done in Canada by their, you know, their department that takes, that looks after food security. And what they found was they infected Ebola in pigs in cages in a room. And they inserted the Ebola virus into the lungs of the pigs, and the pigs, I guess, sneezed quite a bit. And then they had cages of monkeys suspended, like, so there was at least a 6-inch gap between the two cages, so there could be no direct contact between the monkeys and the pigs. And they had a cage of monkeys directly above the cage of pigs, suspended from the ceiling, and they had one over in a corner of the room. And all of the monkeys in both cages got Ebola.
Wow.
And so, it turns out the ones in the cage directly above the pigs got the Ebola, like several, you know, came down with Ebola symptoms an average of 2 to 3 days before the ones in the floor cage. But every single monkey in the room got Ebola from the pigs, even though there was no direct contact with the pigs.
Wow.
Now, when they tried to repeat that experiment with just the monkeys, then there was no transmission monkey to monkey. But the U.S. military did a similar study where they had a different species of monkey, and there was transmission from one monkey cage to the other monkey cage, where instead of inserting it into pigs, they inserted it into monkeys. Now, so no one's done that test with humans.
Right.
I don't think anyone's going to volunteer for that one, but it certainly indicates that, you know, one transmission factor could be, like in Africa, you could have, the pigs actually don't get killed by the Ebola. They get the Ebola and they sneeze a lot, and then they live through it. The monkeys die from Ebola. So it's certainly conceivable that pigs in the African jungle could pick up Ebola and transmit Ebola to their human caregivers.
Right.
That's one of the potential transmission factors. And it's been postulated that a probable transmission factor is through the fruit bats. And that's one of the reasons that Ebola can show up in one part of Africa and then show up 1,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
In another part is that the fruit bats can fly long distances. They're called flying foxes. They have like a 2-foot wingspan, you know, and they've got a body. The body is about the size of a good-sized bunny rabbit.
Yeah, if they weren't herbivores, they'd be like the scariest animal on the planet, really.
Yeah, they are herbivores. They eat fruit.
Right.
But, And so they live. They don't get killed by the Ebola, and they harbor the Ebola. So their scat can bring, they can leave Ebola traces on fruit, and they can leave scat around, and then other animals can pick it up. So the monkeys pick it up, and they get really sick, and then they die. But they can transmit it to others, and the pigs might, you know, root around on the fruit and pick up the Ebola from the infected fruit from the fruit bats, and then spread it to their human caregivers. So you're going to see Ebola keep coming and going in Africa forever, you know.
Right.
And now, one of the other good news things is that they were working on a vaccine. And I'd kind of assumed, because Ebola had been a big part of the military, you know, the bioweapons programs, both in the Soviet Union and in the U.S., Ebola and Marburg, which are similar viruses. And so I'd assumed that they really did have a vaccine somewhere in the back room somewhere. And apparently they had a vaccine that was ready for human trials, but there's no money in it. You know, it was poor black people in Africa dying in small numbers. So
exactly.
There was no money to justify the 20 million or 50 million that it takes to run stuff through the FDA. So they just never did it. So now they've got trials that are starting up in Africa, and they're anticipating that they will have a vaccine, you know, sometime in the next year or so. So I think we've dodged the bullet on this one, but I think it's really important that people have backup. You know, it's like we all buy car insurance, and none of us says, gee, I want to get in a head-on collision today because I got car insurance. It's like, and you don't say, well, I didn't get in a wreck yesterday, so why do I need insurance today, right? I mean, nobody says that. It's like, no, you buy insurance just in case. So having these, like, top 10 things on hand is so important, because you don't know what's going to happen in our world. You don't know, you know, if Ebola is going to get loose, and suddenly our, you know, 2% slack in our medical system is eaten up, and everything's overloaded, and people are being turned away just like Liberia, and they're going home and infecting their wives and their kids and their parents, and it's spreading to their families and their caregivers. I mean, we're not very far away from that scenario happening.
Well, no.
It wouldn't take much to push us around the edge. So I think it's only prudent that we have these top 10 things. And so I've got a modified list here. I mean, I have the list in my book, When Disaster Strikes, and I have an even larger chapter on alternative healing and meds and herbs in When Technology Fails. But there's a couple of new things in When Disaster Strikes that I wasn't aware of when I wrote When Technology Fails. And so I'll just go through this list real quick now if you want.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic. And I want to just preface by saying, you know, this is exactly why I wanted you to come on today, because regardless of whether or not this pandemic, takes hold, there are so many other events that being prepped for this particular one will benefit you for in the long run. You know,
that's correct.
We could have the EMP, we could have the solar flare, we could have, there's all kinds of things that could happen. So being prepped for this, especially...
Extreme drug-resistant tuberculosis is out in the world right now. I mean, think about a few years ago, there was that guy was on his honeymoon in Europe, and he got tested. He had a bad nagging cough that wouldn't go away and got tested before he left, and it turned out he had the extreme drug-resistant tuberculosis. Hmm. And they tried, tracking him all over the world. They finally, arrested him in Canada and made him stay in isolation until they flew a CDC jet with guys in bunny suits to escort him back to Atlanta for treatment. I mean, they were that worried about this getting out in America. So there's plenty of other bugs out there, and it's not just Ebola, that don't respond well to modern drugs. And so, having these backup things. Now, realize that I'm sharing information. I'm not a doctor.
Correct.
There's a lot of data on a lot of this stuff, but they're not FDA approved because they're not patented. So there's no drug company that can have a 20-year monopoly on it and charge $1 billion and make the money back to pay for the $20 to $50 million it took them to get it through the FDA.
Exactly.
So you're never going to see this stuff go through the FDA unless, some government agency decides that it's worth, spending the money themselves. But usually they spend money on things that drug companies, have the money, and they put the money forward and say, this is what we want you to study. And they say, here's the money. And it's like, okay, so here's what you should have. My top one is buy 1 or 2 gallons of the 10 part per million ASAP, or it's called Silver Biotics. It's, by American Biotech Labs. Now, the scuttlebutt in Africa is that people are successfully treating Ebola with this patented nano silver. And now there are different people who make nano silvers, but there's a patented one from American Biotech Labs that's got like millions of dollars of science behind it. And they've got a patent on it, and it's a particular nano silver made through a particular process, and it has a three-phase. It's unlike just a plain colloidal or ionic silver, which you can make yourself, which I suggest you have on hand to do in case you run out of the patented nano silver stuff, which is expensive. You can make stuff for pennies a gallon, by yourself.
Right.
The homemade colloidal silver is toxic to all known pathogenic bacteria. And it may help deactivate viruses, but it kind of has a one-shot use. It bonds to something, it deactivates it, and it's gone out of your system. The nanosilver that's patented has a three-phase. It acts more like a catalyst. It has a part of it. It has a couple electron shells that go back and forth and give off a small, tiny little burst of photons in the ultraviolet range. And then there's another sort of catalyst type action, and then there's the third action, which is basically the same as colloidal silver, where it bonds to things. And this nano silver bonds to virus sites and deactivates them. And it's been proven clinically against the most deadly form of bird flu virus. It's 70% fatal. And they did an animal, a rodent challenge study, and they found that it was far more effective than Tamiflu and any known pharmaceutical in deactivating and in zapping the bird flu virus. Now, is there any science about it on Ebola? No. The scuttlebutt from Africa is that they're using it in Africa and it's kicking it. But that's secondhand. I can't state any, scientific paper to tell you that.
Okay, and we ought to clarify also that here at Red Pill Reports, we don't give any medical advice. This is just for your education and entertainment purposes only.
That's right. And I don't sell it. I'm not making any money off of it.
Neither do I.
And you're not making any money off it.
Okay.
So number two is MMS, Miracle Mineral Solutions, developed by Jim Humble. And he, it's been credited with being a cure-all. I can tell you from personal experience, it's not a cure-all. I have I have a toenail fungus from my rock climbing shoes in the 1970s in Yosemite called an EB with a rubberized layer that was famous for growing, fungus in rock climbers. And I spent, you know, days and days in my rock shoes in the walls of Yosemite. And the MMS makes that fungus go crazy. So, and apparently Jim Humble has a similar fungus from the, and he's used it to heal himself, and over 100,000 other people have healed themselves. This is not a doctor. And it's used in clinics in Africa to heal people 2 days from malaria. And they've used it for a wide variety of things, skin cancers, all kinds of things. And, you know, probably it would do really well against Ebola from the chemical reactions of it. Is there any tests on it? No. Should you have it on hand in case? I would recommend it. I have instructions in my book. You can also find them on the internet for how to mix it up yourself and how to use it yourself. And it basically, you're experimenting with it on yourself and playing with it. And I suggest you do some of that for some simple things that don't really matter. And then someday, maybe some nasty bug's coming down the pipeline and you'll say, hey, I'm going to try MMS because nothing else is working. And it's nasty stuff. It tastes like you're drinking bleach. It tastes pretty terrible. Andres Kalker, who heard about MMS, was quite skeptical. He had crippling arthritis in his fingers. He couldn't make a fist. His fingers were all swollen and thick, and they were useless. He couldn't pick up a suitcase. He did MMS, and he'd been credited with arthritis cures. And in 3 days, his hands were fully functional again, and he was blown away. And he tried years of doctors and steroids and all kinds of things, and nothing worked. So you can pick up videos of Andres Kalker about MMS. He's a German filmmaker who lives in Spain. And he's working with a bunch of medical clinics using it for a variety of ailments in Spain and in other places in the EU. So there's a lot of good science behind it and stuff. It's not just some, you know, bogus voodoo thing. The next one is grapefruit seed extract, often commonly known as GSE, for grapefruit seed extract, GSE. You can get it at most health food stores. It's a strong antiviral, antifungal, and antibacterial. And that's really, really bitter stuff. So mix it in a tall glass of water or juice, and then it's palatable. Okay. But boy, if you don't mix enough water with
it's about the most tart thing you could ever put in your mouth. I've used it for if I've got a sore throat or something like that. I'll take like 2 drops and mix it with 8 ounces of water and gargle that. And it does work. It'll knock anything out of your throat. And that's actually something that comes back from my old, opera singing days. That was something that we would use, if anybody was coming down.
Whoa.
Yeah. Back in the day when I was in college, that was what I did.
Okay.
But anyway.
The next one is a blood electrification device from the Beck Protocol. And that's Bob Beck, who's an interesting guy. I gotta go pretty quick through this list, but he invented the electronic flashbulb when he was a teenager. And he sold it for $1,000. Back in those days, it was a lot of money. And it paid for his last year of his undergraduate, physics degree. And the guy who bought it made $25 million off of it. So when I was a kid, you know, we didn't have strobe flashes. We all had these throwaway flash bulbs, and that's what Bob Beck invented as a teenager. And he worked on the board of a bunch of medical companies, and his health was failing in his mid to late 40s. He had sedentary lifestyle, terrible diet, no exercise. And the doctor said, well, you know, sorry, Bob, but, you know, some people are just aged sooner, and, you know, you're one of them, and there's nothing we can do for you. And he thought, well, I'm not taking this lying down. He poured through medical journals, and he said, I'm an inventor, and I'm on the board of these medical companies, and I design medical devices. And he came up with 4 different electronic devices, 2 which are now combined into 1, and it became the Beck Protocol. And he invented the modern colloidal silver generator. And then all of this is based on research done by other people that he just applied into these devices. And then he also took the research from Albert Einstein University. They had a patented device for blood electrification. And they found that microelectric pulses of a certain frequency and voltage would kill all pathogenic bacteria and viruses in the bloodstream. So they developed this patented device to take your blood out, circulate it through the electrifier, and put it back in your body, kind of like a kidney dialysis machine.
Right.
Well, Bob figured out that you could take a couple of electrodes and strap them to your wrist and have this little simple circuit that runs off a 9-volt battery and crank up the circuit, and it'll electrify through your skin. And it feels mildly unpleasant. You're getting, you know, light shocks in the wrist. And he's sit down and watch TV for 45 minutes or an hour and a half. And when you do this for a month with dark field photography, you'll see all the weird viruses and things floating in your blood a month earlier are just totally gone. All the cells look clean and neat, and the weird stuff that's floating around is just gone.
Wow.
And so it was developed originally for AIDS and Hep C, but similarly, you know, any virus you can apply that to. Now, I think that you should also have a nebulizer on hand, because when you take colloidal or ionic silver internally and you drink it, your kidneys are pretty good at taking it out of the blood, and I found that it's never been very effective against lung ailments. You know, gargling with it's great, but getting it into your lungs. So a few years ago, when I had the Spanish flu, it only got me really sick for like 3 days, but I had this nagging cough that just wouldn't go away. Mm-hmm. And my son says, "Dad, you've got the nanosilver, you got a nebulizer, use it." So I thought, okay, you know, I pulled it out, and I never even used the sucker. I'd had it there for 2 years.
Right.
And I did a 10-minute treatment with a couple ounces of nanosilver in the nebulizer and breathing it in, you know, inhaling it deeply. It was gone. And I repeated the treatment for 3 days, but I never coughed again after the 10-minute treatment. And I had a 3-week cough that just wouldn't go away.
Was that the 10 parts per million that you were using?
Yeah, the 10 ppm. You can also get it through doctors in the 30 ppm, but
right.
It's the 10 ppm nanosilver. It's Silver Biotics. I mean, there's a bunch of people who, it's private labeled, so there's probably a bunch of nanosilvers out there that are the same stuff that are just bottled by other people and private labeled. But the stuff, you can also get it at GNC Live. You can get it at Vitacost.com at a significant discount. Or you can get it direct from ABL, American Biotech Labs, on the internet. Mm-hmm. So the Sota Instruments, S-O-T-A, at Sota, S-O-T-A, like Sota Pop, but with a T instead of a D, .com, they sell and make all of these Beck protocol instruments. But if you want information on how to use the Beck protocol, Sota doesn't give that. They're just selling an instrument that is for general well-being. And you're a, quote, experimenter on yourself, so if you want information, you have to go to bobbeck.com or sharinghealth.com. And those are nonprofit websites from nonprofit organizations that can share information and anecdotes. So people are just sharing information. Anybody who makes this stuff and makes any medical claims gets shut down by the FDA or the Canadian equivalent of the FDA or an AMA. So they're very careful about that. Now, number six on the list is elderberry extract.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off, brother. We are narrowly running out of time here. We've got about 20 seconds left until the end of the show. I really appreciate you coming on. We're going to have you back on to go over the rest of this list.
All right. We're going to publish the article, Ebola Coming to a Theater Near You, and what you can do about it. All this info will be there. It's also in my books. So stay healthy, stay free. God bless, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate you being here. This is Red Pill Report. Take care. See you guys tomorrow. Tomorrow's guest is going to be Dane Wigington. We're going to be talking about chemtrails, geoengineering, all kinds of wonderful things. My name is J.D. Morris. This is Red Pill Reports. We will see you guys tomorrow. Take care, everybody.
We think first of vague words that are synonyms for progress and pair them with footage of a high-speed train. Science is doing lots of stuff that may or may not have anything to do with us. See how this guy in a lab coat holds up a beaker? That means we do research, but we also do business in the USA, or want you to think we do. Check out this wind energy thing in Indiana, and this blue-collar guy with dirt on his face. Lest you think we're a faceless entity, look at all these attractive people, using a specific ratio of Asian people to black people to women to white men. We want to make sure we represent your needs and interests, or at least a version of your skin color in our ads. Did we put a baby in here? Yep.